Daniel Levitin is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, you were going to take us back to music.
Well, one of the many interesting things about what you've written is the evolutionary effect of music, the ancient quality of it, but how central it is to a social creature, this particular social creature. And it seems in many ways, as you describe it, to form a substrate of who and what we are, both as individuals, but also as communities. And that's not irrelevant to the science you're talking about.
I agree. Yeah. If you look back, also, there's this debate about whether music came first or language came first. And it seems pretty obvious to me, if we look at our animal cousins, if you look at the panhoots of chimpanzees, the calls they make. I know that you've spoken to a number of primatologists in the past.
Some of my best friends are bonobos.
And a number of primates, actually. Some of them happen to be human.
You look at humpback whales. The vocalizations of many animal species are more music-like than they are language-like. And what I mean by that is they deal with relatively fixed repertoires that vary in pitch and in dynamics and rhythm, which is what music is. They're much closer to music than speech. So I think it would require, for someone to claim that speech arose first in humans before music, would require ignoring mounds of evidence about how animals communicate.
Which is deeply unscientific.
Right, and it would require a kind of leap that suddenly we sort of set aside our musical inclinations, developed language, and then came back to music later.
Well, in a way, this is the you know, it's the same mindset, it seems, that got us to Homo sapien, that we think we're smart. Mm-hmm. And we just sort of we self-identify as being sapient.
As the XTC song says, we're the smartest monkeys.
Well,
maybe.
As Jared Diamond says, we are the third chimpanzee.
Yeah,
but
the naked ape, mm-hmm. as Desmond Morris says. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that tendency to assume that, you know, that we take language very seriously. We think it is those same people that you're talking about. Also, that is now the last bastion of what separates humans from everybody else, and we've spent years, millennia, trying to separate ourselves from the animals.
Yeah.
And
make ourselves special.
And part of that, I think, the eagerness to make language that kind of specific and sort of write music off is it's one more way that we think we can do that.
I'm glad you brought this up, Bill, because what we used to teach in psychology and linguistics was that one way that you could distinguish Homo sapiens from all the other species was our language. Our language was special. And there had been, over the last 30 years, a great effort there had been to sort of delineate our language from the others and say what makes it special. And two of the things that supposedly made our human speech communication different was recursion, the ability to have embedded and self-embedded clauses, and also the fact that it was infinitely expandable. There's no such thing as the longest sentence in the English language, because anything that you propose is the longest, I could always add to the front of it, David Bowie said that, and then that same whole sentence, or something like that.
And in fact, he did.
And if he didn't, Iman would have corrected him.
But in the last couple of years, what it's just come out in Nature and a couple of other journals, and it hasn't yet filtered out to the public, that in fact those characteristics of human language are in fact present in other animals. There was a very important study done by Daniel Margoliash and colleagues where they show that songbirds can demonstrate recursive operations and extendability in their song. They don't do it naturally, but you can train them to do it. So the brain mechanisms that were so special in humans are there in birds, and you're talking, our common ancestor with birds is at least
long way back.
Yeah, millions of years back. And they've got the capacity. They haven't learned how to exploit it, but it's there.
Neuroplasticity is something you talk about a lot when you're talking about this.
I want to say, I don't want to be coy about this. You're talking about Steven Pinker.
Right.
And he represents a well-known scientist, a very intelligent person, done a lot of...
Pinker is.
Yeah.
Good work. And there are substantive reasons to disagree with what his conclusions are. But that is the joy of science. That is what this community is all about. And we tend to forget that. We tend to think that science delivers the truth. And having delivered it, that it's fixed forever. And, of course, that's just not the way it's done.
That's a good point. It
sounds like neuroplasticity to me.
To get back to your point.
Sorry. Well, but that is precisely the point, isn't it? That there is always more input. Things do change. We are affected by our environments. Big ideas are good, and then you build on them. It's sort of like you listening very respectfully to Steven Pinker and saying, I don't think so, and going off and figuring it out and doing the experiments. And it's not all that different from being in a band where you think, that's a pretty good riff. I'll try that.
Yeah, and I guess I think of science as being somewhat like a courtroom. So there are rules of evidence. Only some things are admitted. Some things are not admissible. So if I do a study and I just tell you about it, that's not admissible. I have to have it published and reviewed by my peers, and it has to appear in a peer-reviewed journal. Otherwise, it doesn't count. You have a judge and a jury, which are, the scientific community, and we provide evidence. And people can disagree as to how to interpret it, just as in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the challenges in this, and gets us back to the language piece, is language is also very, very malleable. And a lot of these discussions, you talk about, we have friends that were at the Santa Fe Institute, you talk about your time at the Long Island, at the...
Cold Harbor.
But there are lots of these kinds of meetings where, particularly if you cross disciplines, the language becomes the first barrier, because when I say white, you really, you see 22 shades of it, and I see one shade of it, because I've been studying something else, and I have this fixed notion.
And you call it something different.
Well, and part of this is in what it's part of what makes science so interesting. It's part of what makes music so interesting is the richness and the complexity of it, and the opportunities to take one perspective, enhance that, take that someplace else, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Daniel Dennett, the philosopher and a colleague and friend of mine, says that he sees the job of the philosopher in all of this, especially in contemporary neuroscience and cognitive science. The job of the philosopher is to ask the questions, and he says, just to fend off any criticism, he says. Now, you might be thinking, what a puny job that is for somebody to ask questions all day long. But it's knowing which questions to ask that advance the field, knowing that perhaps there might be a disagreement about terminology, and asking the question of a number of people in the field, what do you mean when you use this term? When you talk about neuroplasticity, are you talking about a process? Are you talking about something that changes over time? Is it dynamic? Is it a principle? In what ways can we observe it? How can we test it? How can we measure it? These are important issues that need to be settled among the community at large.
When you talk about Dennett, whom I've not had the pleasure of meeting, he quotes somebody as he's sort of talking about his approach to thinking and asking these questions. He quotes somebody who I think was a surgeon who says, I've cut many times into the human brain. I've seen many brains. I've never seen a thought.
Isn't that a great quote?
Oh, it's a wonderful quote. And it takes me to how you describe your own sense of the work, that the mind-brain dichotomy, if you choose, but the different ways of thinking about thinking and thinking about both the brain and the mind. And you choose to really focus on the mind part.
Yeah.
They can come together, can't they? These are not two different arenas.
Well, like Dennett and like John Searle and Paul and Pat Churchland, cognitive scientists, I believe that thoughts arise from the brain and that it's not really a distinction. They're just two sides of the same coin. The brain is the circuitry and the hardware, and the thoughts arise from it. But in terms of my own research, although I do study the brain and I have an active research program in mapping the brain, I'd say 75% of my energy and time goes into looking at the actual thoughts or the mental processes. I'm more interested in things like how memory works, why we remember some parts of songs and not others. More interested in that than which part of the brain is subserving that memory. Although, in many cases, knowing that can help constrain or inform the other set of questions.
Well, and that's part of it. What I think, has improved about science. We've gotten past this binary state, whether it's either mind or brain.
You're absolutely right.
It is. I mean, the answer is yes. It is mind and brain, and they are closely related. And again, part of this is a definitional challenge, and I would assume you and your colleagues spend a good deal of time on definitions, trying to understand exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The one philosopher who comes to mind, and this is exactly total of what I know about this philosopher, is Heidegger, who tells us mind, brain, and context. And when 100 years ago, Heidegger, before he turned into a Nazi, I forget that part, said you have to think about context, which is a huge additional piece in thinking about all of the sciences, in thinking about music, and in thinking about how we will be back in just a moment with Daniel Levitin.
Sein und Zeit.
We'll be right back.